So I want you to just imagine a single molecule for a second.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. So in one room, you have a doctor who's carefully administering this exact molecule to a patient. And this patient has been paralyzed by severe treatment-resistant depression for like 17
Oh,
years.
17 years.
Yeah. And within an hour of getting this molecule, that depression actually begins to evaporate.
Which is incredible.
It is. But okay, in the room right next door, a teenager inhales that exact same molecule, and within a few weeks, the protective insulation around their spinal cord is completely stripped away, leaving them permanently paralyzed in a wheelchair.
I mean, it really sounds like science fiction, right? Or at least like we're talking about two completely different chemical compounds.
Exactly.
But we were talking about the exact same substance here. It's just operating under totally different physical rules.
Right, which is why we are doing this today. Welcome to our deep dive into a really fascinating, fresh article from July 4th, 2026, in the OATW Journal. It's titled Nitrous Oxide Neuroscience, the NMDA Antagonist.
It's a great read.
It really is. And our mission for you today is to decode what has to be the ultimate, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde of the medicine cabinet. Because nitrous oxide is literally the oldest anesthetic we have, right?
Oh, absolutely.
It's got this pristine 175-year clinical safety record. So my framing question for you is, how is it possible that a drug we've known about since, I think, 1772 is suddenly the most misunderstood molecule in neuroscience today?
It is baffling, especially when you look at our history with it. I mean, Joseph Priestley synthesized it in 1772, and people were literally paying to inhale it at these traveling laughing gas parties decades before the Civil War.
Hey, really? Laughing gas party.
Oh, yeah, it was a whole spectacle. So you'd think, after 2.5 centuries of recreational and medical use, we would have its biological blueprint entirely mapped out.
But the article makes it pretty clear that we just didn't. Like, for most of its history, doctors knew that it worked, right? It numbed pain, it made you giggly or unconscious.
Right, but without really knowing how it was doing it.
Exactly. And now that modern neuroscience is finally, looking under the hood, we're realizing the seemingly simple gas is incredibly complex. So to understand this whole extreme contradiction, let's start with the main mechanism.
Let's do it.
The paper classifies nitrous oxide primarily as a non-competitive NMDA receptor antagonist.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, right. So in plain English, what is it actually doing in the brain?
Okay, so think of the NMDA receptor as a gateway for glutamate. And glutamate is basically your brain's main excitatory neurotransmitter.
Like the on switch.
Exactly, the primary on switch for electrical activity. So when nitrous oxide enters the system, it acts like a bouncer blocking that gateway.
Okay, I like that. A bouncer.
Right, so it dampens that excitatory signal. And that is what creates that classic feeling of dissociation and anesthesia. You're fundamentally just turning down the brain's baseline volume.
And because of that specific bouncer at the door mechanism, people are constantly comparing nitrous oxide to ketamine because ketamine is, the other famous NMDA antagonist. But reading through the pharmacology in this journal, I mean, calling it just an NMDA antagonist feels like a massive understatement. It's doing so much more than blocking one gateway.
Oh, absolutely. That multi-target effect is actually what makes its clinical profile so totally unique, because it's also interacting with GABA-A receptors.
And that's the calming system, right?
Yeah, that's the same inhibitory system that alcohol and anti-anxiety meds target. Plus, it triggers the mesolimbic dopamine
The
pathway.
reward center.
Exactly, which completely explains why some people get this intense euphoria and, why it carries an addiction risk.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit because it's not just a single instrument playing here, it's a whole orchestra. It also mentions that it opens these two pore domain potassium channels, specifically one called TREK1,
Yes, the TREK1 channels.
which I had to look this up, but essentially, by opening those channels, it acts like a physical brake pedal for the neurons. It raises the threshold required for a neuron to fire a signal, which adds heavily to the sedation.
A physical brake pedal is a great way to visualize it. But what's fascinating here is that the sheer variety of receptors it touches isn't even the most unique part of its pharmacology.
Really?
No. The real secret to nitrous oxide, the thing that drives both its medical promise and its recreational danger, is the physical speed of the molecule.
Ah, you're talking about the blood gas partition coefficient.
I am.
The article lists it at 0.47, which sounds very technical.
It does. So let's translate that into how it actually feels in the human body. In physics and physiology, a coefficient of 0.47 is astonishingly low. It basically means the gas barely dissolves in your blood at all.
Okay.
What about dropping a rock into a glass of water versus dropping a piece of sponge?
Right, the sponge soaks it up.
Exactly. But nitrous is the rock. It doesn't dissolve into the fluid. So the moment you inhale, it hits your lungs, saturates the blood almost instantly, and the pressure between your lungs, your blood, and your brain just equalizes in a matter of seconds.
It's like a biological flashbang grenade. You just inhale, and the room's chemistry resets instantly.
That's a perfect description. And the reverse is also true, because your body doesn't metabolize it at all.
Wait, not at all?
Not at all. Your liver doesn't have to produce any enzymes to break it down. It simply diffuses back in your lungs the moment you breathe fresh air. You exhale it completely unchanged.
So the effects just clear in minutes.
Literally minutes.
Which is why that ketamine comparison falls apart a bit, right? Like, they might both block the NMDA receptor, but ketamine is processed by the liver.
Yes, and it breaks down into active metabolites, like hydroxynorketamine, which linger in your system.
Right. A ketamine session can leave you feeling groggy for hours, whereas nitrous is just instant on, instant off.
Precisely.
But wait. Let me pause you here, because there's a detail in the pharmacology section that completely threw me. The researchers note that the pain-relieving effects of nitrous oxide can be attenuated or weakened by giving someone naloxone.
I was hoping you'd catch that.
I mean, naloxone is Narcan. It's an opioid blocker. Are you telling me that a basic gas we use for filling cavities is somehow, like, hacking our brain's internal opioid system?
It fundamentally hacks the system, yes.
That is wild.
It really is. Inhaling nitrous actually triggers your brainstem, specifically an area called the periaqueductal gray, to release endogenous opioid peptides.
Which are our natural painkillers.
Exactly. That release creates a cascade that suppresses pain signals traveling up your spinal cord. So it's heavily leveraging your internal opioid network without actually containing any opioids itself.
Oh, wow.
And preclinical data even suggests it has unique downstream action on certain potassium channels, like SK2, that ketamine totally lacks.
Okay, so if the pain relief is that instantaneous and it leaves the body that quickly without a hangover, it makes total sense why psychiatrists started looking at it. I mean, they saw this huge revolution ketamine was bringing to depression treatment, but they clearly needed something with a little less baggage.
Right, because ketamine proved a massive point for psychiatry. It proved that blocking the NMDA receptor could lift severe depression in a matter of hours.
Rather than the weeks or months that traditional SSRI pills take.
Exactly. But ketamine requires a clinical setup. You need an IV or a monitored nasal spray, and there's significant recovery time. So the scientific community naturally asked, well, could the oldest NMDA antagonist in the world do the exact same thing, but clear the body fast enough that the patient could just drive themselves home?
Which brings us to the antidepressant frontier. Enter Peter Nagel's team at Washington University. The trials they've been running are just incredible.
They really are groundbreaking.
And just a quick note for anyone listening who is suddenly wondering if they should, you know, ask their therapist for laughing gas. This is still highly investigational.
Yes, very important to state. It is not FDA approved for psychiatry.
Right. But the data from the past decade is staggering. So in a 2015 proof of concept trial, they took patients with treatment-resistant major depression, gave them a 50% blend of nitrous oxide for 1 hour, and saw rapid, significant drops in depression scores.
Which was a vital first step. But that 2015 study had a pretty big flaw.
Nausea.
Right. At a 50% concentration, a significant number of those patients experienced severe nausea and vomiting. And if a psychiatric treatment makes you violently ill, its broader application is going to be incredibly limited.
Yeah, people won't want to do it. Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because that brings us to the 2021 crossover trial published in Science Translational Medicine. This is the one that really caught my attention.
Oh, this trial changed everything.
So they took 24 patients who had been battling severe depression for an average of 17 years.
Think about the weight of that number.
17 years of trying every pill, every therapy, and just failing. And they tested a 50% dose of nitrous, a 25% dose, and a placebo gas.
And the findings completely disrupted our assumptions about dosing.
The aha discovery. Because the 25% dose worked just as well as the 50% dose for lifting the depression.
The efficacy was virtually identical.
But at 25%, the nausea and vomiting basically vanished.
Exactly. It completely rewrites the risk-benefit calculation. finding a fast-acting treatment that clears the body instantly with minimal side effects at low doses, I mean, that is a holy grail for treatment-resistant depression.
But reading that made me wonder something. If 25% works just as well as 50% for mood, does that mean we've been over-sedating people in the dentist chair for decades simply because we didn't know the minimum effective dose for the brain?
It's super easy to jump to that conclusion, but we have to look at the clinical goal, right? A dentist and a psychiatrist are trying to achieve two entirely different things.
Okay, how so?
Well, a dentist is performing a painful physical procedure. They want you sedated, they want you largely immobile, and they want you numb. That requires the heavy 50% dose.
That makes sense.
But a psychiatrist doesn't care if you're sedated. They are just trying to trigger a very specific neuroplastic cascade to reset your mood networks. So discovering that you can trigger that psychiatric reset at a much lower, gentler dose, that's the real breakthrough here.
But there is a massive catch. And the article pivots incredibly hard here. Because that exact same pharmacokinetic trait that makes it clear the body so fast, that 0.47 coefficient, the whole flashbang effect, is the exact same trait that drives a catastrophic wave of injuries.
Right, because it feels fantastic for 60 seconds.
Yeah.
And then it completely vanishes.
Exactly. The brain says, well, the drug is gone. I'm totally sober. I might as well take another hit.
And then another and another.
And that heavy, repeated exposure triggers a biological catastrophe. Which brings us to the harm, the B12 catastrophe.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, in supervised medicine like dentistry or using Entonox for labor pains, nitrous is always given with adequate oxygen, and it's for short, defined periods.
Giving it a pristine safety record.
Exactly. But the danger isn't the gas itself. It's the pattern of sustained, oxygen-deprived exposure that breaks down the body's fundamental cellular machinery over months of recreational use.
And the mechanism of injury described in the paper is just merciless. Like when you inhale heavy recreational amounts of nitrous oxide, it attacks your vitamin B12.
Yes, it does.
But it doesn't just like lower your levels. It physically rusts the core of the molecule. It irreversibly oxidizes the cobalt atom sitting at the center of the B12 structure.
Rusting the core is such a perfect way to visualize oxidation because once that cobalt atom is oxidized, the B12 is permanently inactivated.
Wow.
And your body relies on active B12 to run an enzyme called methionine synthase. When that enzyme shuts down, you develop a functional B12 deficiency.
Wait, so even if someone goes to the hospital and gets a blood test?
Their B12 levels might look totally normal on paper. The vitamins are physically there in the blood, but they are broken and useless.
And the downstream effect of that broken enzyme is the real horror story, because B12 is required to maintain myelin.
Right, the protective sheath around your nerves.
So heavy use is basically stripping the rubber insulation off the electrical wires in your spinal cord.
That's exactly what it's doing. The medical term is subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord. We're talking about young, healthy people getting severe tingling, numbness in their hands and feet.
And it gets worse from there.
Much worse. They lose proprioception, meaning they can't feel where their legs are in space. They develop a staggering gait, profound weakness, and eventually ascending paralysis.
The journal even notes that ER doctors often misdiagnose it as Guillain-Barré syndrome because the symptoms are so similar, and they're seeing peripheral neuropathy, megaloblastic anemia, which is basically massive, abnormal red blood cells.
Not to mention the acute risks, like severe hypoxia and even frostbite to the lungs and lips, because the gas expands and freezes as it leaves these pressurized tanks.
But let me ask the obvious question here. If someone is heavily using, but they just take a ton of B12 supplements, does that protect them? Or is the gas just instantly deactivating the new B12 as fast as they swallow it?
It's the latter. You cannot out-supplement active, heavy nitrous exposure.
Because the cobalt atom just gets permanently oxidized immediately.
Precisely. The moment you introduce new B12 into a system saturated with nitrous oxide, the gas instantly attacks and rusts those new cobalt atoms too. The only way to stop the degeneration is absolute permanent cessation of the gas, followed by high-dose B12 injections for weeks or months.
And even then, neurological recovery is really slow, right? Often incomplete.
Very often permanent.
Which is terrifying. This irreversible nerve damage used to be an incredibly rare medical anomaly. But as we live into the 2026 landscape, a recent shift in how this gas is packaged and marketed has turned this into a nationwide emergency room crisis.
It really has. If we look at the CDC MNWR data from April 2025, just focusing on Michigan, poison center calls, EMS responses, and ER visits tied to nitrous spiked 4 to 5 times higher between 2019 and 2023.
4 to 5 times higher.
And across the U.S., nitrous-related deaths rose well over 100% in a similar window.
And the culprit is the shift in packaging. It used to be those tiny little whipped cream chargers, right?
But yeah.
You had to crack them open one by one, which naturally limited things. But now it's these massive, cheap, flavored catering tanks sold at vape shops. They call it Galaxy Gas.
They're heavily flavored. Strawberry, mango, vanilla, which is a clear indicator they aren't just for professional pastry chefs. And these catering tanks enable exactly the kind of sustained, nonstop, heavy dosing that rapidly destroys myelin.
This raises an important question. Well, actually, you usually say that, but seriously. So what does this all mean for regulators?
This raises an important question indeed. How do you even write a law for this?
Exactly. How do state governments effectively ban a paralyzing neurotoxin when that exact same substance is required to make a whipped cream cake or painlessly deliver a baby?
It is a regulatory scramble. Because it's not a federally scheduled substance due to those legitimate uses, the FDA did issue massive consumer warnings in March and June of 2025 about the flavored tanks.
But warnings only do so much.
Right. So states are scrambling.
Yeah.
Louisiana passed House Bill 64 to restrict sales to legitimate uses. States like Michigan and Oregon are desperately adding age limits and trying to ban the flavored products completely.
Which brings us to the big takeaway here for everyone listening. Nitrous oxide is the ultimate proof that asking, is this drug safe, is just the wrong question entirely.
Absolutely. The right question is, at what dose, with what oxygen, and how often?
Exactly. When you're catching up on health and science, remember that the truth usually lives between the extreme headlines. It's not just a miracle cure, and it's not just a deadly menace. It's both, depending on how it's used.
The physical context is everything.
Right. And I want to leave you with one final original idea to ponder today. We talked a lot about how nitrous oxide exerts massive neurological changes while completely sidestepping the liver, being inhaled and exhaled unchanged.
The ultimate fast in, fast out.
Yeah. So could this unique instant on, instant off respiratory delivery mechanism, rather than pills that have to be digested and linger in our bloodstream causing systemic side effects, could this actually be the physical blueprint for the future of psychiatric medicine?
It's a profound thought. Bypassing the liver entirely could completely change how we approach mental health interventions in the next decade.
It really could. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.